Afghan capital, Kabul. I mean, talk to us about the significance of the recent Taliban gains, and also the UN has mentioned that a humanitarian catastrophe is on the rise.
Well, Bhatia, the Taliban are advancing rapidly all over Afghanistan. They have captured several provincial capitals over the past 24 hours. For instance, they are currently controlling 18 out of 34 provinces of Afghanistan. But the fact on the ground proves that the recent provinces were fallen into the hands of Taliban without any strong resistance by Afghan security forces. In some cases, local officials have handed over some provincial capitals to the Taliban, mainly in southern part of this country and northern areas. Ghazni city, the capital of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan, was handed over to Taliban by Dawood Laghwani, the governor of this province. Later on the day, when he was heading to the capital Kabul via Kabul Herat highway, he was arrested by Afghan security forces in Maidan Shah, the capital of Maidan Wardak province in central, very close to Kabul. In the meantime, the Taliban also captured the capital of Logar province, that is the city of Puli Alam. However, the intense fightings are also underway in most areas of Kunar province in eastern Afghanistan, as well as in Laghman and Nangarhar provinces, again in eastern Afghanistan. This comes as some top political leaders in Afghanistan, especially in northern part of this country, are still insisting on resisting against the Taliban militant group. For instance, Atta Mohammed Nur, the prominent political leader in northern Afghanistan, as well as the Marshal Abdurrashid Dostum, recently declared their commitment to strongly resist against the Taliban militants in case they continue to further launch attacks on the city of Mazar-e-Sharif, the capital of northern Balkh province. Marshal Dostum named this strategic province in northern Afghanistan, in Balkh province, as the entrance gate of Afghanistan. And he said that under the strong support receiving from locals, we will successfully defeat the Taliban not only in Balkh province, but also across the entire northern Afghanistan, and then across the all provinces of Afghanistan. This comes as top U.S. officials has also asked President Ghani to resign. The demand has so far been not rejected or confirmed by the Afghan presidential here in Kabul so far.
All right, thanks a lot. I mean, Press TV's Amin Alimi joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have our guest, senior analyst, foreign policy and focus, Ian Williams, who's joining us from New York. And research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, who's with us from Budapest. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ian Williams in New York. Mr. Williams, what do you make of this offensive? Why did everything unravel so fast for the Afghan government? All right, unfortunately, we're experiencing some technical difficulties with Mr. Williams in New York. Mr. Williams, stay with us as we get that sorted out. I'm going to address that same question to Mr. Samueli in Budapest. Mr. Samueli, what do you make of the Taliban offensive, the recent gains that they've made so rapidly? Why did everything unravel so fast for the Afghan government?
Well, I think it's unraveled very fast because of complete demoralization and incompetence on the part of the Afghan government. I mean, there are two separate issues here, which is the situation for the United States, and then there's a situation for the Taliban. So without question, this has been a profound humiliation for the United States. I mean, they've been fighting against the Taliban for 20 years, and then they announce that they're going to withdraw, and the whole edifice that they've created over 20 years just seems to collapse really within a matter of days. So that is, without question, a debacle. the other question, I think, is that will the Taliban ultimately prevail? And that I think, is far from certain. I mean, if we looked at Afghan history, I mean, there's always a pattern whereby somebody is on the offensive, it seems that the opposition melts away, then the victorious army marches into Kabul, takes over, and then the opposition just regroups in the countryside, in the mountains, and then it in turn starts resisting against the ruling group. So we had this, remember, back the Soviets who took over Kabul in the late 1970s, and look where that got them. They immediately were facing enormous resistance in the countryside. Then eventually the pro-Soviet government collapsed, and then we had a civil war between the various Mujahideen factions that fought it out during the early 90s. The Taliban was triumphant in 1996, but they in turn were facing resistance from the Northern Alliance. And you remember in 2001, the Taliban melted away pathetically as the Afghan government is melting away. And they, of course, in turn then regrouped and mounted their own offensive. So this is a pattern in Afghanistan. It is a very difficult, complicated, diverse country to rule over. I mean, it's hard to even describe it as a country. I mean, it's a warlords, it's regions, it's religious differences, ethnic differences. You've got Uzbeks, Tajiks, Pashtuns. Very hard to rule it over. So I don't expect the Taliban to have a particularly easy time of ruling. And if they continue in this way, ignoring the entreaties of the international actors such as the United States and Russia and China, and just simply press ahead for victory, they're going to end up in disaster, just like they did in the period of 1996 to 2001, when they were diplomatically isolated. No one recognized them other than Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Pakistan, and thus they were very vulnerable to attack to the United States, and no one said boo when the Americans invaded.
Back to New York now, Mr. Williams. What does the current situation say about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, about the $1 trillion spent, all the claims of propping up and equipping security forces in Afghanistan? Why aren't the security forces having any success against the Taliban right now?
As lots of people have pointed out, it's Vietnam all over again. The rosy reports from politically inspired generals to meet the politicians' demands in Washington to show that the taxpayers' money and the conscripts, their soldiers' lives were not being wasted. So the reports came out, they were completely Panglossian. And remember, this is all of their own making here. This is blowback to the maximum. They originally set up the Taliban with the help of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and the others to fight the Soviets. So it was blowback. They came back and bit them. And the same thing is still happening now. Remember, it's a U.S. ally funded, with the military funded and trained by the U.S., Pakistan, which has been covertly helping the Taliban all of this time. It's a very murky situation in which nobody really seems to care about the Afghan people, which the Afghan people have noticed. They knew that the U.S. wasn't propping up the fight against the Taliban to protect them or to protect women's rights. It was in their geopolitical interest to do so, and it was in the interest of politicians back in Washington to pretend that they were fighting the good fight. So I agree, but from now on, I think the Taliban have got some hard going, because they're hitting up against the rock. Dostum, the Uzbeks, the people in the north, the old Northern Alliance, they're ever heavily armed, loaded for bear. They've got no time for the Taliban, and they will fight back. And just all around the country, it's a heavily armed country, everybody is heavily armed. The Taliban have shown no sign of catering to popular opinion. And not just where they're alienating women, intellectuals, lots of other people. They're going to be every bit as arrogant as the Americans, with the only distinction that they look like the locals, and which the Americans never managed to do, even when they wore the strange Afghan hats. So it's a mess of America's making. They came into Afghanistan allegedly with a UN backing, we should remember, because of the 9/11 incident. But immediately that was hijacked by those politicians in Washington and diverted into a crusade against Iraq, rightly or wrongly, most of us think. But they went into Iraq. That's where they put all their forces, and they left Afghanistan on the back burner. They didn't they didn't pursue the victory, the military victory that they'd had. They didn't really pursue the nation building. They made it very plain. They treated the local politicians with disdain.
Right.
I mean, just think, a year or so ago, they started negotiations with the Taliban without even telling the politicians in Kabul. How is that for showing your disdain and contempt? How do you expect Afghans to go and fight and die in a war where the Americans are going to sign off on it without telling them what's happening?
Okay, let's cross over to Mr. Samuel Lee. Mr. Williams brought up an interesting point. That's the negotiations that started around last year in Doha. Those negotiations, I believe, are still taking place there. What relevance do they have now at this point? What are the objectives and goals of such talks at a time when the country is being overrun by the Taliban?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, of course, they should be of relevance because if the Taliban doesn't want to end up as disastrously as they ended up from 1996 to 2001, then they should engage in some kind of negotiations under international auspices to set up a coalition government, a multi-party government, you know, all the factions in Afghanistan, and try to rule as part of a coalition. If, as is likely, the Taliban isn't going to do it, if it is likely that they're just going to press ahead for victory, then I think they're heading for disaster, because it's already clear that its neighbors, the Central Asian countries, are very much now already aligning themselves with Russia. They're engaging in military preparations. Should there be any trouble coming from the Afghanistan, I think the Chinese are very wary that a Taliban-ruled Afghanistan will become another fount of Islamic fundamentalism. I mean, the Chinese are already very wary of their Muslim population in Xinjiang and concerned, you know, what the impact of the Taliban would be then. So if they just press ahead for victory, I think they're going to find themselves isolated and probably subject to all manner of subversion from its neighbors, who have every incentive of making life as difficult as possible for the Taliban. So they'll be sponsoring Northern Alliance and various indigenous insurgencies against the Taliban. So, if they're intelligent, then they would take these Doha talks seriously. I suspect they're not, and they're going to head for the same disaster they ended up in 2001.
Ian Williams, will a Taliban rule Afghanistan in 2021? Will it resemble the previous time that they were in power in the 90s? What will Afghan life be like in the areas under Taliban rule?
I suspect it's going to be horrifying for, you know, for women, for anybody who's independent-minded. These people don't want to be in a coalition. They could have been in a coalition any time. They could have been part of a coalition government. They've been offered that for the last 10 years or more. No problem. They don't want a coalition. They're getting their orders from God, and they're not going to take them from anybody else. They're not going to accept mediation. So they're going to carry on behaving frightfully. All the signs are, wherever they've gone in, they've engaged in retaliatory shootings and executions. They're going to carry on with the same ideological, theological agenda, and they're going to alienate the people. And this time, of course, they're weakened because the infidel are out of the equation. The one claim to legitimacy that they had was that the infidel US was on the Afghan territory or Muslim territory. That's no longer the case. They've removed their own sort of best ideological ally in that sense. From now on, it's going to be them versus the co-religionists and their co-nationalists and the neighbors as well. You know, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, they're all there, nominally Muslim, and they are not going to tolerate any incursions from across the border, and the Taliban will almost certainly do that, and then they'll get whacked.
George Samueli, what will the Taliban run Afghanistan mean for the presence of groups like Al-Qaeda and Daesh? Of course, we have to mention the Haqqani Network, which was an Al-Qaeda affiliate that has fought shoulder to shoulder with the Taliban.
Yes, well, that's the one commitment that they made when the Trump administration signed their original Doha agreement, which was that they would not allow Afghanistan to once again become a center for Al-Qaeda, for any international terrorist group. I don't take that very seriously. I mean, they've adhered to it so far that Al-Qaeda hasn't yet returned. It's quite likely that, Al-Qaeda, various Islamic fundamentalist groups will return. And again, if that happens, then the Taliban will be very vulnerable to its neighbors. So you've got, Iran, you've got Russia, you've got China, you've got the Central Asians, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, all of whom are very, very anxious about Afghanistan becoming once again a center of Islamic fundamentalism. I mean, this is a longstanding concern of its neighbors, and the Taliban has done very little to reassure its neighbors that it has learned its lessons and it will never again become the center of international terrorism. So I do think that it is quite likely that all of the Al-Qaeda types are going to be back, and disaster beckons for Afghanistan, sadly.
Ian Williams, what about Pakistan, a main variable in Afghanistan's Taliban saga? Where do you see Pakistan in this equation?
Well, it's not just Pakistan, it's also Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. The U.S. has never dealt with them. The U.S. has still not dealt with the Saudi role in the original 9/11. It closed its eyes for geopolitical reasons. It closed its eyes all these years to Pakistan. I mean, there was Pakistan hosting the leader of Al-Qaeda in one of its big garrison towns, and nobody knew. Well, there might be non-halal, but pigs were flying all the way through Pakistan when that was happening. And they took no notice whatsoever. And the U.S. took no notice because they were playing Pakistan for other geopolitical reasons. They have never had a connected, joined-up foreign policy in Washington. They've appeased Pakistan when it's suited. They appease Saudi Arabia. Do you think those elements in Saudi Arabia really love the Americans and the Israelis? They're waiting there for their time to come back for more. And they will provide the resources for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and whoever. And the U.S. hasn't done anything about the source, so it can't complain when it flows down onto them. And it really is a mess of Washington's own making almost all the way through, which is bad. It'd be good to have what the Germans call Schadenfreude, joy at other people's discomfort, but the Afghan people are going to suffer from this. They are suffering from it. They suffered just as they suffered when the U.S. originally got the Taliban in there. This was on the way to becoming a sort of fairly progressive secular democracy up to a point. Women engineers, women pilots, etc., all cast back to the Middle Ages with U.S. support and army. That was the situation when blowback was on. That was the situation that set it for the blowback of Al-Qaeda and 9/11. Now it's deja vu all over again, as the famous American philosopher said.
And very briefly, if you may, Mr. Samueli, give us your thoughts on where Pakistan falls into all of this.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that Pakistan has been playing a very two-faced game in all of this. It's pretended to be supporting the United States' global war on terror, whereas, of course, all along it has seen the Taliban as its instrument. It was a mechanism for the Pakistan to dominate Afghanistan. And as your other guest pointed out, the fact was that bin Laden, and I believe it was to get bin Laden that the United States invaded Afghanistan, bin Laden made his home in Pakistan. I mean, it's ridiculous to try to argue that the Pakistanis did not know that bin Laden was peacefully living in its country. So they knew he was living there, and they left him alone. They, you know, let him go on living there in comfort. They never notified the United States he is here. And in fact, the Pakistanis were very indignant about the U.S. raid that actually eventually killed bin Laden. Hey, you know, our sovereignty has been violated. So yeah, I mean, Pakistan has been playing a two-faced game. The United States has known that it's playing a two-faced game, just as the United States has known for decades that Saudi Arabia plays as a two-faced game, pretending to be a supporter of the global war on terror while actually financing these terrorist groups all over the world.
Well, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thank you, gentlemen. Senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, joining us from New York. Also, thanks to Research Fellow Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. And also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
Oh, the thought on my mind that how grateful we are to have you, oh Hussein.
Insight into the Holy Quran.
And I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan al-Darisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we are trying to talk about the different verses of the Holy Quran, which are thematically connected to our topic, which is Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So stay with us, and let's listen to some of the verses.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And abide in your houses, and do not display yourselves as was the display of the former times of ignorance. And establish prayer, and give zakah, and obey Allah and His Messenger. Allah intends only to remove from you the impurity of sin, O people of the Prophet's household, and to purify you with extensive purification.
Brothers and sisters, in this program, we'll have another approach towards the recognition of Imam Hussein and actually all of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam. We all know that Almighty Allah's attributes are not merely verbal. I mean, they're mostly objective and, they have external realizations. The first attributes that manifested themselves from the invisible God at His will are four, according to a narration, and seven, according to others. Of course, they all can refer to the same one name, But the first attributes are the ever-living, all-knowing, all-powerful, and the speaker. Each of these attributes has a domain and property for itself, and there is a longing in them for manifestation. This is what I mean by having objective and external realization. Since Allah is comprehensive of all the attributes, it generally holds other attributes and somehow does not allow an attribute to emerge alone. Now, in the previous program, we said that the universe actually needs these divine men, these Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. Each part of the universe that was materialized with Almighty Allah's most excellent names is governed by that attribute. So, it is necessary that someone comes into existence to be a full manifestation of Almighty Allah's chief name and create a balance among the concrete names of Allah, so they will not interfere with each other. In other words, the universe is in need of a perfect man who is the manifestation of all most excellent names as well as the chief name, so as to be able to administer all the affairs as Almighty Allah's vicegerent with His permission. Even angels, who are abstract beings and cannot be seen, and each of them is assigned with a special duty, are in need of Almighty Allah's vicegerent. This vicegerent and Khalifatullah must be there to control them in their affairs and teach them what is necessary and what is not.
O people, compete with each other in attaining noble traits, and hasten to acquire lofty benefits, and do not count those good deeds which you have delayed.
Now, of course, this reasoning was rather long. Let me sum it up for you. Based on Quranic verses and narrations, the universe is in need of a khalifa, a khalifatullah, a vicegerent. And this need is constant. I mean, even if no human beings had been created, the universe was still in need of a khalifatullah. The first human being of our kind, Adam, was also in need of a khalifa. He needed that vicegerent so that his affairs would be administered justly. But because no one else was created, he himself was Khalifatullah, in order for that position to be a link between him and Allah. Now, based on this imperative need, Allah has chosen a vicegerent for himself and made him rule over universe. قَالَ إِنِّي جَاعِلٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ خَلِيفَةً. The Almighty Allah said, I am going to place in the earth a khalifa, a vicegerent. Now, this khalifa would rule the highest stages of the universe. Although the earth is the lowliest of the low, potentially this position is the highest in terms of ranks on the earth. That's why we can claim that the enemies who stood against Imam Hussein alayhi salam were committing the worst wrongdoing. They were standing against the only human being on earth as the vicegerent. He had the highest ranks on the earth. This is the man that can collect within himself all attributes of Allah and become the most active element of universe thanks to its mere passiveness. That's why the Holy Quran says, وعلم آدم الأسماء كلها. He taught Adam all of the names. Adam being taught all these names means he was the manifestation of all the names of the Almighty. Dear listeners, we will inshallah talk about the different features of Almighty Allah's vicegerents in the next programs. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
دمعت عليك ظلت تنزل جروح يا ابو اليمة بمصابك ذابت الروح طلب راي توفقني بخدمتك ولا تحرمني من الدمع والنور يا ابو النعمة وباب للرحمة أدري توفيقي هو أسبابه إلك أسأل وانت تتفضل من توظفني خادم ببابه
English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
Ibrahim Raisi handed to Parliament a list of his proposed cabinet ministers a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators now have 1 week to review the credentials of Raisi's picks before an open vote of confidence session is held with the presence of the president himself to defend his nominees.
For 1 week, 13 parliament commissions will be working 3 shifts a day where they will be host the proposed ministers, asking them about their plans and visions. 3 days after the one-week time frame is over, open sessions will be held in Parliament where the proposed ministers will take the podium one by one to lay out their plans and take questions from lawmakers.
The list consists of 19 nominees for 19 ministerial posts. Among the proposed names are Hossein Amir Abdullahian as the new foreign minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani as the defense minister, and Ismail Khatib as the intelligence minister. Lawmakers seem to not have issues with the proposed list and have promised to be cooperative with the new administration.
There will definitely be synergy and convergence between Parliament and the government. We need to work together to solve the country's economic problems. We are determined to remove the illegal sanction imposed on the nation, so lawmakers and the new administration must join hands to achieve this goal.
Ibrahim Raisi won the June 18th election by a landslide, securing 64% of the vote. He was sworn in on August 4th, 2 days after he was officially endorsed by Iran's leader. Raisi had 2 weeks to introduce his proposed cabinet lineup, but he released the list a week ahead of the deadline. Parliament says it will be swift to review the nominated ministers in order to speed up the formation of the new cabinet.
If all goes as planned, open floor vote of confidence sessions will be held after the week-long deliberations over the credentials of the proposed ministers will conclude behind closed doors. Given the close ties between the Iranian parliament and the new government, lawmakers expect that the vote of confidence process will wrap up in a matter of 3 work shifts. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an attempt to blunt international opposition to Israeli settlement construction in the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is pushing through plans for more than 2,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank, and at the same time has decided after long years to grant a rare authorization for 836 Palestinian homes in Area C of the occupied West Bank. It's virtually impossible for Palestinians to get construction permits from Israeli authorities. Palestinians say Bennett is trying to deceive the world by the so-called equalization.
All this announcement is just to tell a fake message to the world that we are equalizing, and you know, so we give the Palestinian permissions. It's not true that we are destroying. This is like a wrong message that will be given to the international community. We should confront it as a Palestinian, and also international community should also confront that. This is a Palestinian occupied land, and Israel don't have the right either to build the settlements or to give the Palestinians in their homeland and permission to build their houses.
Under the interim Oslo Agreement signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Israeli regime in 1993, the West Bank was divided into three areas: Area A under Palestinian control, Area B under Palestinian and Israeli control, and Area C under full Israeli control, and this comprises some 60% of the occupied West Bank. Israel prevents Palestinians from constructing private or public buildings in Area C under different pretexts, such as using the land as military training zone, or it locates close to settlements and other claims.
Israel is controlling Palestinians' lives in these areas. It prevents them from constructing new homes in their own lands. The new move is aimed at covering up Israel's future plans for new settlement projects in the Palestinian lands.
At the end of the day, it's almost impossible for Palestinians in Area C to get Israeli-issued building permits. Moreover, Israeli forces on a daily basis destroy and demolish Palestinian structures in the same area for lack of construction authorization, despite the policy deemed illegal by the international community.
Palestinians don't take Israel's new move seriously, saying what matters for Tel Aviv is to execute its plan known as the Classified C Areas, which is aimed at putting an end to the presence of Palestinians on the mentioned areas. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
To show its goodwill to find a peaceful solution to the years-long crisis in Yemen, Yemen's Ansarullah has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the current crisis.
The initiative put forward by the Ansarullah leader serves the interests of all Yemeni people. I believe it is an appropriate opportunity for all conflicting sides to get out of the current predicament and avoid military battles. With this initiative, Ansarullah reaffirms once again that it is keen on finding a political solution to the conflicts in Yemen.
The spokesman of Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdul Salam, said the initiative includes stopping the Yemeni army's operations in Marib, reactivating the Marib gas station to generate electricity for all Yemen, and forming a joint administration from the people of Marib to maintain security and expel the terrorist groups from the city.
The initiative launched by Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi is aimed to stop war in Marib. The people of Marib should have the final say when it comes to their political fate. Meanwhile, the roads must be open for the free movement of Yemenis. This initiative is an appropriate measure that will benefit the Yemeni people and establish a comprehensive political and economic solution to the current crisis.
The free movement of all Yemenis, Abdul Salam said, should be guaranteed, as well as the release of all the detainees from the prisons of the Saudi-backed forces in Marib. Ansarullah's initiative came in conjunction with the UN's appointment of Hans Grundberg of Sweden as its new envoy for Yemen.
Many here say changing the UN envoy will not solve the problem, because as things stand, this is the US which controls the situation and leads the war on Yemen behind the scene. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Hundreds of thousands of local Afghans have fled their cities and villages in northern and northeastern provinces due to back-to-back collapse of most provincial capitals in the north and northeast to Taliban. Some displaced families have arrived in the capital Kabul, and they have nowhere to go but the roadside or parks like the one here in central Kabul. That is why they welcome any move that could mitigate their misery. the advances have displaced more families across the country. Some displaced people accuse local officials of making secret deals with Taliban.
Our city fell to Taliban without any exchange of fire. The same story went on in Ghazni city, where its governor was arrested by the NDS over handing over the city to Taliban. This proves that there are some secret deals behind the collapse of our cities.
The displaced Afghans urge warring sides to stop turning more cities into the battlefields by resuming a meaningful intra-Afghan negotiation.
We, the people of Afghanistan, are the main victims of war. We have lost all we had. Ceasefire is the only way to get out of the current crisis. The government and Taliban must sit for talks and resume a meaningful negotiation.
Afghan government has ordered the country's Ministry of Awqaf and Hajj to open the doors of all mosques in government-controlled areas for displaced families, and that the government is going to fully support them under close cooperation with the international humanitarian agencies. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Meet Nura, an Iranian-made COVID vaccine which is now making a name for itself. Developed by Iran's Baghiyatullah University, affiliated to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the vaccine wrapped up the first human trial stage and now kick-started the second phase.
The first trial phase involved giving jabs to 70 people. The vaccine has not created any serious side effects in the volunteers, so we can now conclude that the vaccine is safe. The second phase will cover up to 500 volunteers, and the third and final stage will inject Nura to at least 20,000 people. It's only then we can decide on the efficiency of the vaccine.
Nura is a recombinant vaccine, which experts say provides stronger immune response to the virus compared to jabs that work based on other methods, such as mRNA and inactivated virus. Nura is administered in three stages. The first and second doses are injected 21 days apart, and the third one is administered 2 weeks after the second shot.
Well, Nura jumped a bit late on the bandwagon to fight the coronavirus. It stands out as the only Iranian vaccine that can be administered to children and teens. Experts hope that this would make it safe to reopen schools.
With less than 1 month and a half left to the upcoming school season, authorities in Iran are still debating whether or not to resume in-person classes, which have in the past year given way to online learning. Nura developers say they're trying their best to get their jabs to the market, as they're certain that their vaccine will protect children between 12 and 18 against the coronavirus.
Based on our studies, our vaccine is both safe and effective to be used for people between 12 and 18 years old. Simultaneously with the second trial phase, we'll also kickstart the first stage of the trials on volunteers from this age group.
Developers say if all goes as planned, Nura will hit the market in 3 months. This as Iran has already rolled out its first local vaccine dubbed Coviran, with a monthly output of up to 15 million doses per month. The country also plans to release Covpars, among other jabs, within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has blasted the decision to hold joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in South Korea this month. Her statement, read on official media, also called for the removal of U.S. troops and weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. is determinedly pushing forward with these aggressive war drills when international attention is focused on the development of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. It is indeed the chief architect destroying peace and stability in the region, and this also proves that diplomatic engagement and dialogue with no strings attached touted by the present U.S. administration is hypocrisy to cover up its aggressive nature.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has reached out for, quote, unconditional talks with Pyongyang. Although U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program remain in place, experts consider North Korea's perspective.
The most important thing is the content of the joint exercises. Officially, they are described as defensive in nature, but if you look closely, they employ very offensive strategies, preemptively striking North Korea, removing state leadership, and capturing North Korean territory. It's threatening from the North Korean standpoint.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in had been trying to generate peace with North Korea, but Seoul's close alliance with Washington and purchase of major U.S. weapons has hindered his efforts toward Pyongyang.
The decision to go ahead with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises has already impacted inter-Korean relations. In late July, hotline communications between the two Koreas were restored after being severed for more than a year. However, since the announcement of the drills, North Korea is no longer answering South Korea's calls. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After 5 years of the closure imposed on Sana'a International Airport by Saudi Arabia, Yemen has held a protest inside the airport to renew their demands and call for its reopening. Protesters chanted slogans urging the international community to push Riyadh to remove its merciless blockade on Yemen.
The closure of Sana'a International Airport has caused a major humanitarian crisis and it is a war crime. Yemenis are not trapped and considered hostages. The Ministry of Health statistics confirmed that more than 95,000 patients have died because they were unable to travel for treatment, and 480,000 patients urgently need to travel and their fate is unknown amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. There are also 4 million expatriates who want to return, but the airport closure prevented them.
The repercussions of the Saudi violation of international covenant on civil and political rights and closing Sana'a International Airport are getting worse, especially to those with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and liver, who hope to travel abroad for proper medical treatment, but unfortunately it seems impossible at least for a while.
5 years since the closure of Sana'a Airport, which is not a short period, it has caused an exacerbation of human suffering because the airport is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis. Before the war, 6,000 passengers, including 100 patients, used to leave every day from Sana'a Airport. More than 30 patients die every day due to the restrictions on the airport. There are more than 70,000 cancer patients and 20,000 kidney failure patients who need to travel for treatment amid the collapse of the healthcare system due to the fuel crisis caused by the Saudi detention of Yemeni oil ships.
At the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen besides its war, resulting in the closure of Sana'a International Airport to all flights and trapping millions of Yemenis, including patients, in a war zone. However, Sana'a Airport still receives the United Nations flights alone on daily basis.
Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this airport. People here say the Saudi blockade goes against international law and its requirement that everyone should be free to leave any country, including their own. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The continuing fallout over Britain's Prince Andrew's friendship with the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, a lawsuit brought against a Duke by mother of three, Virginia Giuffre, who alleges she was trafficked to the Prince by Epstein and his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, when she was 17 and forced to sleep with him on three occasions. In a statement later, Giuffre said the powerful and rich are not exempt from being held responsible for their actions. I hope that other victims will see that it is possible not to live in silence and fear, but to reclaim one's life by speaking out and demanding justice. But the Queen's son denies any wrongdoing.
Things only started snowballing after that infamous interview. The humiliated royal was evicted from his private office in the building behind me at his mother's orders. Add to that the slew of companies and institutions that severed all ties with him.
66-year-old Epstein is said to have committed suicide in a U.S. jail in 2019, a month after he was arrested over sex trafficking charges. His partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, has pleaded not guilty to those charges and is awaiting trial in November. It is yet to be seen how the Duke or the beleaguered British royal family will emerge from this new looming storm. Saeed Purizza, London.
Saudi Arabia issued sentences against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians residing in the kingdom, with some handed jail terms up to 22 years, while acquitting a number of detainees. Among the detainees is Hamas senior member Mohammed al-Khudri, who was sentenced to 15 years. His son was also given a 3-year jail term. Palestinians have slammed the court ruling, saying it follows the Israeli goal of defeating the Palestinian resistance.
This was shocking news for us, as we never expected things would reach this level. They sentenced the national man who is representing his country and works within the law of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed didn't pass the limits, and he was guided and directed by Saudi authorities. It is really sad for us, as they don't have any right to sentence him to this term. This verdict is unjustified.
In February, al-Khudri had a surgery. He was being treated for cancer when Saudi authorities arrested him. Al-Khudri, who has been in charge of working on ties with Saudi Arabia for 2 decades, is now on a wheelchair inside the Saudi jail.
I hope things will be better and we will get our brother and his son released, as he is an old man while his health is deteriorating. He has recently done a surgery for his cancer and he is on wheelchair. I hope Saudi authorities reconsider this ruling and stand by the Palestinians.
Hamas and the Palestinian factions have condemned the sentences, calling them unjust, saying those sentenced had done nothing to harm Saudi Arabia. Hamas also welcomed the acquittal of some of the detainees and called on Saudi authorities to quickly release them.
We totally condemn this decision and reject the ruling against our sons in Saudi Arabia, and we consider them political prosecutions. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the right to sentence those people who didn't commit any offense against the kingdom and its people. This is an unjust decision, as Saudi Arabia has always supported Palestinians, but now it is trying to satisfy the U.S. and Israel. We call on Saudi authorities to release those detainees.
Palestinians here say the Israeli move further sours relations between the Palestinian nation and Saudi Arabia, calling on Riyadh to release those detainees, as they have caused no harm and not committed any offense. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Iran has condemned the remarks by European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible. Speaking at his online weekly press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh rejected the accusations as baseless, saying blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Israeli regime and that the comments by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region.
Such remarks by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. Tehran has summoned the British and Romanian envoys in Tehran to register protest against the baseless allegations. The fact that Britain has sided with the rebellious and notorious Zionist regime shows the position of this country.
In reaction to a statement released by the G7 against Tehran, the official said the country will not remain silent in the face of the security of its commercial vessels. He further noted that the security of the Persian Gulf is Iran's red line, and that the country has always tried to keep this waterway safe from insecurities created by such countries as UK.
Iran is concerned about the obvious violation that the UK did against an Iranian oil tanker in international waters in July 2019. But the security of the Persian Gulf is the red line for Iran. Tehran has done its best to protect the waterway from insecurities orchestrated by countries like the UK. We advise the British government to pay attention to its own responsibilities and duties.
Tension has been escalating in the region in recent weeks against the backdrop of a suspected drone attack last week that targeted an Israeli-managed tanker, Mercer Street, off the Omani coast. the regime in Tel Aviv and its Western allies, the UK and the US, accuse Iran of orchestrating the attack. Iran has vehemently rejected the charges as baseless and childish. Moreover, Tel Aviv said it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. But Iran has already warned of a crushing response to any such move.
Iran describes as suspicious a number of reported security incidents in the Persian Gulf region and has warned against any effort to create a vicious atmosphere to pursue certain political goals. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In the limelight. Ma'arib Provincial Governor in Yemen's National Salvation Government, Major General Ali Mohammed Tayman, said the country's army troops and fighters from allied popular committees will establish full control over the entire district of the central province of Ma'arib in case Saudi-led militants refuse calls for a ceasefire in the strategic area. We're prepared for you an article written by Karine Jaffery, an independent journalist and blogger, under the heading Yemeni Government's Initiative for Ending War in Ma'arib. Simultaneously with the appointment of the United Nations new envoy to Yemen, consultations as well as political and diplomatic pressures, and of course the United States and the UK's entreaty for an end to the war in Yemen, sustain themselves. The Yemeni army and popular committee's extensive victories over the past 2 weeks have caused the American side to finally despair of stopping Ansarullah movement through military means and seek out another approach. It was for this reason that the White House's envoy for Yemen made several trips to the region over the recent weeks. She visited Riyadh and Muscat, meeting with the country's officials. The Saudi side practically fights for the Americans and lacks all internal inclination towards the continuation of the war. However, it is trying to exit while still saving its face. For the American side, the fate of the city of Ma'arib is very important, and it is engaging in the consultations for the same reason. Over the past 7 years, the British and the Americans did not spare any crime against the Yemeni nation, crimes of such enormity that just some things slightly resemble them have happened in a country such as China or Russia. These countries would have had 7 or 8 resolutions issued against them and face hundreds of condemnations on the part of the bogus Western human rights organizations. Nevertheless, all these pressures led nowhere, and starving the Yemeni people did not make them sell out their scruples. The West's heavy investment in Ma'arib province did not bring along any victory for them. Their direct interference in the war in the city showed that although they may be the bigger in numbers and have greater equipment at their disposal, they have nothing on the Yemeni fighters in the area of designing and enacting battleground operations. Simply put, it should be said that the Emiratis departed from the battleground about 2 years ago and admitted defeat. The Saudis are awaiting the smallest sign on the part of London and Washington, and the latter, too, themselves are facing a deadlock, too. The Sana'a forces are leading a winning strategy, which features a gradual approach towards the city. Their scenario comprises laying a siege on the city, either directly or taking it under a barrage of fire. Doing this, they would be leaving the coalition's forces just one outreach pathway. through Hadramaut province. The Marib battle signifies greatly, since defeat in it equals the defeat of Mohammed bin Salman's adventurism in Yemen. Moreover, the war has impacted greatly on Saudi Arabia too, because it has caused it to come under successive rocket and drone attacks by Yemen's Ansar Allah movement. The war casts a long shadow on Saudi Arabia. However, after the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman's trip to Muscat and on a demand made by the Omani side, Yemen's National Salvation Government submitted its initiative.